Mark Wahlberg, founder of the Contrarian Codex. Welcome to The Competent Investor. How are you? Thanks for joining me.
I'm doing very well, Tom. The last time we spoke was a few years ago, but that was a great pleasure. And I'm glad to see that you are setting up a great platform, and I'm honored to be part of it.
Of course. You know, it's interesting, the chats that we've had over the years, and to be able to revisit, you know, kind of timestamps through this market. And, you know, it's everybody's super focused on gold and silver with, you know, obvious implications, obvious geopolitical implications, economic implications right now. But there is an incredible market happening in the uranium sector right now. And, you know, I just wanted to get a sense from you of where this market is at. You know, you recently wrote in one of your reports that you spoke with somebody that works in the industry, that the sheer amount of things that need to go right to even have a chance to balance this market is insane. So why don't you walk us through a little bit about what is happening in the uranium market right now?
Yeah, it is super interesting right now. And that quote was one of my favorite quotes that I took away from the WNA. For those listening right now that don't know what the WNA is, it's a World Nuclear Fuel Association, or World Nuclear Association event, rather I should say, that is an annual event where basically all the biggest companies in the nuclear power space and all the big names and all the analysts come to discuss the nuclear power sector, and as an extension, of course, also the uranium sector. And that quote, it really encompasses everything that kind of comes with this sector, because right now, even though since the last time we spoke, even though the price of uranium, and I'm specifically referring to the term price here, because you can also look at the spot price, which is the most obvious price indicator to look at because it's the easiest to track. But one could argue that the term price is actually the real price, because that's where 75 to 80% of all market activity or physical market activity happens in the uranium space. So since the last time we spoke, the term price has risen substantially. It is at $82/$83 right now. And if we would have had this conversation back in 2020 and the price would be at $80+, the conversation that we were about to have would be completely different. And the reason for that is that over the past few years, we have seen a massive amount of cost inflation, and we have seen a massive amount of projects not coming online on budget, on time, or not at all because of various either skilled labor constraints or just because the price wasn't high enough. So what we're seeing right now is that even though the price has risen a lot, and even though originally a few years ago this would be an incentive price that one could argue would provide a balanced market, that is simply not where we're at now, right now, which means that we have further to run. Because one of the main things that was discussed at the WNA as well was that at the presentation of the fuel report, you can see that all the way through to 2040, there is a massive cumulative supply demand deficit. So basically what you're seeing is that when it comes to coverage, it's extremely tight out there. European Union utilities are usually better covered than their US counterparts, but their coverage drops to 75% by 2027. In the US, only 55% of their needs are covered by 2029. So if you look at UxC estimates, we are looking at 400 million pounds that must be contracted by 2030 and over 2 billion pounds by 2040. Now, for those listening that are perhaps not as obsessed with the uranium sector as I am, as you might want to call it, 2030 and 2040 might seem like a lifetime away, especially in the volatile and relatively short-term mindset market that we're at right now. But for these utilities, for these end users, 2030 is literally tomorrow, because they need to account for a 2 to 3 year fuel cycle between securing the physical uranium, that going through the entire fuel cycle of conversion, enrichment, fuel fabrication, and then coming out on the other end as fabricated fuel that you can actually put into a reactor core. That time frame needs to be taken into account. So they already need to start thinking about, all right, what are we doing in 2029? What are we doing in 2030? And that is something that is happening right now. And that actually also made for one of the most interesting conversations I had at the conference with the fuel manager of one of the largest US utilities, who noted to me three things. Thing number one that I thought was very, very interesting was that he said that US utilities, and that was also for anybody who was paying attention to the market, that was very, very clear, was that US utilities in particular always had a very short-term mindset that was mostly created because there was never the political, monetary, and public support that we are seeing right now. And if you didn't know that if your reactor was going to get a life extension to operate from 40 to 60 to maybe 80 years, of course, you're going to have a little bit of more short-term mindset. But it was also a short-term mindset in terms of how they would look at securing fuel. So there was always abundant supply available from somewhere, either secondary sources in the last bull market, such as via the megatons, megawatts program, or other mobile inventory that was thrown on the market. But what we've really seen over the past few years is that that secondary supply has continued to dry up more and more, meaning that they are increasingly becoming dependent on primary sources of mine supply. And that is something that they simply didn't really have to deal with in the sheer magnitude that they have to deal with it now. So that shift to a longer term mindset, I think, is really important, because that will translate into term contracting that will subsequently push up the term price, which is also good for the equities, of course. The second thing, which I thought was the most interesting, I should probably have started with that, but leave the best for a second in this case, which would come down to the fact that he noted that the supply that they can perhaps procure right now on paper does not necessarily equate to fundamental coverage. Basically, that's what it means, the way that
I actually have that written in my notes here, that coverage on paper is not the same as coverage in the reactor.
Yes, exactly. The way that I've previously called it when I was talking to Contact with Mine on a different interview, I think we did that like a year, 1.5 years ago. Basically, the way I coined that was by saying that you cannot put your balance sheet into a reactor core and expect it to run. So it's all nice and well that you have, for example, 5.5 million pounds of coverage come 2031. But if that is not delivered, then it's all well and good that you have it on your balance sheet, but that's not going to run into your reactor. So basically, they have become more and more aware of the fact that some of these developers or some of these producers may not deliver in the quantities that were expected. And this was further exaggerated by the fact that UxC, which is usually a more conservative utility-focused price analyst that do a lot of good work in this sector, and they stood up on stage in one of the events last year, not this WMA, but one of the last ones, and they basically noted that down the line, the biggest problem for some of these end users, it may not be that you need to pay extra for your supply or that you need to pay a price that perhaps you were not really looking forward to be paying if you would have secured it earlier. But the biggest problem may be that you cannot find the supply in the quantities nor the time frame that you were perhaps looking to do so. So that is just a very interesting observation. And the third observation was that these utilities are very aware of all the support that they're getting right now. They are trading at a premium. If you look at some of these utility stocks, they have absolutely flown to the upside over the past few years. And they are very aware that their nuclear power is trading at a premium. And that is very significant. And of course, that also dictates that they want to secure enough fuel to make sure that their premium power will keep on rolling without a single hiccup. So the fact that they're aware of that, I think, is very significant. So yeah, that made for a very interesting conversation. And my apologies for the kind of long-winded answer. But I think that right now we are at such a significant point. And even though the market will continue to be volatile and it will not be a straight line from here, I am very confident in stating that the term price of uranium will be a lot higher going forward. And because it simply needs to be if we want to have any chance of closing the supply-demand gap.
So, Mart, when you mentioned that that's the only chance we have to close the supply-demand gap, is that because these producers need significantly and sustained higher prices to be able to embark upon really developing these projects because of this long lead time.
Yes, a lot of these really greenfield projects, like the marginal pounds, so to speak, to close this gap, these need to come at much higher prices because we have just gone through a grueling bear market where we've not only seen a lot of capital leave the sector, but also a lot of intellectual capital leave the sector. So a lot of people that actually know how to build and subsequently and adequately produce uranium for sustained periods of time. It is such a bottleneck in this sector. There is such a bottleneck of people that actually know how to do this stuff that will have an impact going forward, that even if the price would spike to $150 tomorrow, sure, it would shake off some supply that is available, but it would do nothing in terms of getting supply available immediately, like perhaps you would see with an oil and gas well. If oil spiked to $150 tomorrow, you would see a lot of response almost immediately, at least in relative terms compared to uranium mining. So I think that's pretty significant, but it's also because at higher prices, some other extraction techniques will also become available to kind of add to that supply. So there are several examples of these, but one example that I will use is uranium extraction from phosphate tills. So phosphate production, if you look at Morocco, for example, which is, of course, a huge phosphate producer, there is an initiative going on there that at the right uranium price, you could see 5 to 7.5 million pounds in this initial plan becoming available to come to the market in terms of production. You could also see further re-enrichment of tails if the laser enrichment technologies that are really trying to prove themselves right now for the coming decade will become more available. You could see some extraction from there. But this will all, a lot of these supply sources and a lot of these additional supply sources will basically only become available at a high enough price. And at a high enough price, when everything is economically viable, if you want to call it that, then we have that chance to close the gap. But for that, a lot needs to go right. And we have already seen that even at these higher prices, that even some of these projects that are on paper, at least more economically viable, have not delivered the way that they presented they would a few years ago. So I think we will see more of that. I think that a lot of these end users and all of the other people that are looking for pounds will continue to be disappointed with the supply side. That doesn't mean we won't get a supply response, but I think that there is a lot that needs to go right in order to fill the gap.
Mm-hmm. So, Mart, at this point, when do some utilities start to actually run out of fuel?
Well, we're looking at US utilities having, I believe, 1.4 to 1.6 years worth of inventory right now. European utilities are a little bit above that, going between 2.5 and 3 years. For some context, with US utilities, they usually strive for 2 years, and European utilities usually strive for 3 years worth of inventory. But on the question whether they will run out of fuel or not, I don't think that they will ever run out of fuel, because at least in the near term as well, they are well covered, as they should be. These are multi-billion dollar critical pieces of energy infrastructure that cannot and will not be left without adequate fuel to keep running. So I don't think we will see any utility run out of fuel, but I do think that the market will reflect what will need to be paid at higher prices in order for them to get the fuel. So basically, when you look at what they perhaps need to pay in order to secure the fuel, like a few years ago, what you saw is that some of these utilities, what Grant also noted, that they basically didn't want to buy term conversion at $18 per kgU. They were more than willing to pay it at $50 per kgU because there was a bottleneck and they needed to secure that conversion. So what you're seeing right now as well is that the term price is going up and it needs to go up further to make sure that these utilities can actually sign the contracts. it will get there. They will never be left without fuel. But I think that the price of physical uranium will, as it always has, follow the price of what we saw with that conversion and also with enrichment, because every single bull market we've had before, and there are three, you could actually count four, depending on how you look at it. Every single time we saw a bull market that was connected within the fuel cycle. So what I mean by that is that you saw the prices of conversion and enrichment rise, and subsequently you also saw the price of term rise as well. So we will see the same thing now. I'm very confident in stating that. But I don't think they will ever be left without fuel. They will pay what they need to pay, because in the end, the price of fuel, if you denominate it by the price of what you pay for physical uranium, is only between 7 and 15% of the total cost of running a nuclear power plant. If you compare that to a gas or coal plant, you're running into the 65 to 75 to 80%, even some 85% on some of these coal plant models that you need to calculate for in terms of your input costs compared to what it costs to run the entire power plant. That is not the same case with nuclear power plants, and they will pay what needs to be paid for in order to secure the fuel.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we're having this real supply deficit, Mark, where do those extra pounds come from if utilities aren't going to run out? Like, if there is a true deficit, you would think at some point that there is a possibility of actually running out.
There is absolutely a possibility of running out if the price doesn't rise to meet that demand, which again, I deem unlikely. But to answer your question, I think that where you need to look for the pounds to come from, I think the biggest sources will, of course, be Canada. Then you look for Phoenix, which is projected to produce around 8 million pounds a year from 2029 forward. You have Arrow, which is projected, and I use projected. Actually, I will use projected in the broadest sense of the word, with a pinch of salt, for a lot of these projects, because if you look back 10 years, some of these projects were projected to come online in 2022 or 2023, and that's continued to be pushed back. So I think that it needs to be taken into account. But if you look at current projections, you look at the Athabasca Basin of becoming a major producer with, of course, I just mentioned Phoenix, but also NexGen's Arrow coming online with a projected 28.8 million pounds a year from 2030 onwards. Again, I think that's going to be later. I don't think it's very easy to bring online such a massive, massive project in the western part of the Athabasca Basin. So I think that there will be some supply that will be available from there in terms of growth. Actually, a lot will be available if that goes well. Of course, Cameco can still ramp up McArthur River and Cigar Lake. Cameco has some other deposits that they can also ramp up, including in Canada, but also in Australia and the US. Speaking of the US, there are also mines there that could add some additional production. So basically in the US, which consumes 50 million pounds of uranium a year, they have produced over the last 3 years, and I had to recheck these numbers because it's absolutely ridiculous, 200,000 pounds 3 years ago, 50,000 pounds 2 years ago, and 680,000 pounds 1 year ago, for a total of 930,000 pounds in a country where nuclear power is such an incredibly important part of the energy system. And again, where they consume roughly 50 million pounds a year. If you talk about energy security, you also need to talk about securing that domestic supply. That is now growing for good reason, because the price is higher. These US uranium miners are being incentivized to produce more. But to the question that I got recently from a subscriber, whether there is any way where we will get close to the 43.7 million pound annual production record that we set in the US in 1980, I don't think there is any way we get there. I think there is a pathway to 10, 15 million pounds, perhaps a little bit more than that. But again, only at the right price. Then there is some uranium production that can come online in Namibia in the form of Bannerman's Etango project and also Deep Yellow. There is also uranium production capabilities in Australia. I say capabilities because especially in West Australia, it's a very uranium-rich environment, but it is not very good in terms of securing the right legislation to actually develop and build and operate a uranium mine. So I am keeping an eye on Western Australia. I'm planning to do a multi-page deep dive in one of the coming newsletters, but I don't think that that will... It will definitely not stop the thesis from playing out, but I think that's something to watch in terms of where more supply could come from. And of course, then you have the elephant in the room in the form of Kazakhstan and subsequently Kazatomprom, which of course is a massive, massive producer of uranium. They will continue to ramp up over the coming years, especially once they get the sulfuric acid plant online and they get Budenovskoye 6 and 7 ramped up to full capacity over the coming years. But Kazatomprom themselves have also stated that by the time we are in the mid-2030s, when the supply-demand deficit really, really starts to bite, it is already here, but it just gets substantially worse over the coming decade. What you're looking at is that they themselves have stated that there may not be enough guaranteed supply for everyone, and that there will be another Kazatomprom-sized producer needed to fill this gap. And I don't see where we get another Kazatomprom-sized producer, especially not as the current Kazatomprom is slowly but surely, like they're ramping up now, but they're projected to peak with their production around the early 2030s. And after that, it just goes down like a ski slope. And at that point, you also see a lot of these legacy mines really start to run out. So I think that is pretty significant. And I think that they need to do a lot more exploration and development to even like replenish the current resource that they have, let alone ramping up even more, because I don't see that happening beyond their current projections. You have Uzbekistan, which is a significant producer as well, and they back in 2021, 2022, they were projected to double their production come 2026, 2027, and going out into the end of this decade. But after that, they restructured that, and they were saying that, all right, maybe we'll double production, but we will add 50%. That is still an increase, but it is nowhere near what their original assumptions were aiming for. And then there are other places where you could see more production. I also already mentioned the phosphate extraction from Morocco, but I think you will also see some more uranium mining in other countries such as Mongolia. Also, Chinese domestic uranium capacity can be ramped up, but nowhere near what they need when you look at their consumption profile. And also, one thing that I want to address as well, when people talk about where a lot of uranium could potentially come from, all these options that I gave because I think they're viable even at high uranium prices. Something that I don't think is necessarily viable even at high uranium prices will be Swedish uranium. And the reason that I kind of want to highlight Swedish uranium here is because it's often touted as the supply-demand bear case for the uranium thesis, because there are two particular Swedish uranium deposits. The companies that own them call them polymetallic deposits, because they also have a bunch of nickel and a bunch of molybdenum and other critical metals. And these, in theory and on paper, hold 1 and 1.1 billion pounds of uranium, which is, of course, a significant amount. But when you look at, and I did a deep dive on this recently as well, when you look at the geology, it is a alum shale hosted asset with uranium concentrates of 0.004%, which is not necessarily high grade. It's super, super difficult to economically extract that. And it's also very difficult to get legislation ready for that, to build an separation circuit in order to extract that uranium. So I don't think that's a bear case. Maybe down the line, at some point, these uranium deposits could be producing. But I think that we're talking about 2040s, maybe even 2050s before that happens. They've tried this before. It didn't work in the way that they wanted it to. It wasn't economical in the end. And I don't see how these new assets form any sort of like major, major supply side response.
Mark, talk us through a little bit about why or the issues surrounding Kazatomprom right now. You know, this is obviously, for those that don't understand, it's basically a Russian producer that as I understand, is heavily tariffed or, you know, restricted in a lot of ways. So what are the, let's say, the legal considerations around Kazatomprom at this point for the rest of the
world? I think for Kazatomprom, I've spoken to management at the WNA as well. And in terms of operational things that they run into, one of the things that should be noted is that their new assets are more geologically challenged compared to their older assets, because of course you want to mine the good stuff first, like the easy accessible stuff. You want to get mined first, especially if you have good customers for it. So these new deposits, they are a little bit more challenging. Budenovsko is a little bit more challenging. You need more sulfuric acid for it. You need more time and effort for it. They ran into some sulfuric acid shortages that kind of forced them to alter their plans, but they are remedying that, I should say, by building their own sulfuric acid plant, which should be online come 2027, 2028. But right now, I think one of the most important things to note regarding what you mentioned, the influence that they have on this market and the influence that's perhaps being put on them by their neighbors, they are a massive seller of uranium to Russia and China in particular. A lot of the uranium, especially going to China, and from a contact of mine from China, has also informed me that if China would get the chance, they would buy every single pound they could from Kazatomprom. Kazatomprom subsequently, and I applaud them for this, have said that they want geopolitical and geographical diversification, so they're not going to sell every single pound to China. But the demand is there for years and years to come to keep selling those pounds. Russia is essentially short physical uranium. They have a lot of conversion and enrichment capacity, but they need more physical uranium, especially with the export pipeline for reactors and domestic reactors that they have on plant. And they need more physical uranium. And of course, they're going to go to their neighbor. They're going to go to Kazatomprom to get that supply. So I think a lot more pounds will continue to stay in the East, stay in that umbrella of influence, if you will. And I also think that another big customer going forward will be India, because again, it is in that same Eurasian umbrella, if you will. And India has very, very aggressive plans to expand their nuclear power capacity and expand also the uranium that they want to buy. They've noticed that they want to 4x the amount of uranium, physical uranium, that they plan to purchase between now and 2031. And I think a majority of that will come from Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. So that will leave even fewer of those lowest cost quartile pounds on the table for Western buyers. So yeah, basically to answer your question, I think that going forward, I think more and more pounds will be staying east. And I think that Western fuel buyers will need to start to think more about, okay, where can we find a really reliable supply source outside of perhaps the supply that we can still get, because there will always be pounds available from those countries that I just mentioned. But they will need to start to think about, okay, where can we get other supply? Can we get some more domestic supply? Can we get some more supply from our neighbors? I think that's an unanswered question that will need to be answered over the coming years, because again, I think more and more pounds from Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan will be staying east because they simply have the right customers there, and there is a substantial amount of demand that they can satisfy at the right terms.
So Mart, backing out a little bit, you have a sentiment rating on the uranium and nuclear power market. Where are we on that sentiment rating, and how do you come up with that rating?
That's a very interesting question. We talked a bit about this off air last time as well, is that the fact that I do not have a background in mining engineering or in finance. I have a background in psychology, which has come in remarkably handy over the past few years when we're trying to determine turns in the market, because sentiment is simply such a rich information source when it comes to the market and when it comes to price action, as you will know as well. And looking at uranium sentiment, especially in such a small market that can really be influenced by retail investor flows, you are looking at retail sentiment being a pretty big driver of price action, at least in the near term as well. Now we're seeing more and more institutional capital coming in. It's becoming a little bit more efficient, especially after a recent rise. But that sentiment indicator still has really big implications, I would say. So right now, we are seeing sentiment at being not yet euphoric, but certainly being very, very optimistic. We were cautiously optimistic before WNA, but afterwards, we saw this rise to the high 80s. So the way that I construct this sentiment indicator is that it goes from score from 0 to 100, with 100 being absolute peak 2000.com bubble vibes, incredible sentiment, absolutely ridiculous. And with one being borderline depression sentiment, which we got to in early April. And after that, it ran up really, really quickly because you can't really drop from the basement floor. Right now, we are a lot higher than that. And the way that I come up with it are a few different data points that I collect and then plug into the sentiment reading. Basically coming down to social media. So the way that uranium is spoken of on just general social media, such as on Reddit or on Twitter, general media. So in what way is uranium covered on the Wall Street Journal or CNBC Fast Money, which is usually a counter indicator, or just Bloomberg articles. Then you also look at the way that uranium is discussed between investors, which really can also provide very, very good insights. And then the final data point is the way that uranium is discussed between more, I would call them industry insiders. So basically participants in the physical market, which would be traders or utilities or analysts. And then you get those four data points, you plug them into the model, and then you get a sentiment reading, which basically right now is, of course, it is very, very, the investors are very enthusiastic. Uranium investments have done very well. And I think that right now, when it gets to like the border of euphoric, I always get a little bit more careful, a little bit more cautious, if you will, because at that point, just like you can't really fall deeper from the basement floor, you also can't really rise up more from the penthouse. And I think that that is very, very important to take into account right now. So we have been taking some profits because it has been an incredible year. We've been talking a little bit off air about this as well, but the fact that some of these holdings have gone up 300, 400, 500%. We were talking about the options play. So the way that I construct my portfolio in the Contrarian Codex is not just on equity holdings, but also on options. And we bought a bunch of energy fuels call options back in early May, I believe it was. And those, at the time of recording right now, are up, I believe, 2,950% over just half a year, which is simply mind-boggling, Tom. And it is something that I hope to be repeating over the coming year, but again, you can't repeat that from the penthouse. You need to repeat that from the basement again. So that's something that I am very proud of, and I'm very glad to see that the community was doing very well. But right now, after the run we've had, yes, I believe that term prices will rise a lot more. I believe that that will mean that equity price will rise a lot more. And I think we have a multi-year bull market on our hands. But that is not without volatility, and that is not without these corrections. So what we saw in the last bull market as well, and then I promise I will stop talking about this, is that we saw, of course, sentiment really, really going hard on the paint. But in the last bull market, we saw that the pullbacks basically were of increasingly greater magnitude. So you saw multiple 30% pullbacks, multiple 20% pullbacks, even some 50% pullbacks. I believe we saw 8 different pullbacks that exceeded 25% over the course of the bull market between 2002 and 2008. And right now, I would be remiss to not at least be a little bit careful if you have sentiment being nearly euphoric and if you have returns exceeding 300%, 400%, 500% in just half a year. But again, over the long term, I'm very confident that this market will be priced even higher than it is right now.
Mm-hmm. Mart, if you wouldn't mind, explain to us why or what the setup was that made you decide to buy call options of Energy Fuels in May. Like, what was coming into the market? What was coming into the news? What made you decide to position yourself that way?
It's a very interesting question, Tom, and I'm glad you asked that, because it didn't just have something to do with uranium. For my readers at the Contrarian Codex, they will know that I write a bi-weekly newsletter that also includes 10 to 15 pages of macro coverage, and I handle a macro roadmap as well, because even though the uranium piece, of course, very strong, even though we also invest in gold and silver, which has also been pretty incredible and has their own catalyst, whether we like it or not, everything is influenced in some way, shape, or form by the way that the macro environment is developing, right? It influences all our investments. So a few years ago, I decided that I need to cover that as well to kind of give a complete picture in every single newsletter. And when we saw I call them tariff tantrums, really kick off in April, I started to look at, okay, where are the real pinch points? Where are the real points of pain for the US in particular if they go into trade war with China? And the best answer that I could come up with was rare earth elements. So these rare earth elements, for the people that know, are not actually that rare. The rarest part about rare earth elements is the processing and turning them into useful products, of which the market is dominated between, depending on what rare earth elements you're talking about, between 75% and 100% by China. They control almost the complete end market of rare earth elements. So when I was looking at this, at that point, I wrote about it as well, that I knew that the US could not go to a trade war with China, holding the rare earth elements card, because rare earth elements are of critical importance, not because the US wants to use them to build more solar panels or to build more phones or whatever other use case they may have, because they're very flexible, but mostly because for the defensive industrial complex, so the army industrial complex in the US is extremely, extremely dependent on Chinese sourced rare earth element products. So if you look at your F-16s or your X-ray vision goggles or your submarines or your missile defense systems, all of those have various sources of these rare earth element denominated products that are just so important for that defensive infrastructure. And the fact that the US, the moment that the US tried to go into a trade war with China, and the moment that China said, okay, well, in that case, we will restrict these exports, you could see an immediate reaction in US Treasury market volatility. Subsequently, you saw an immediate reaction in the US dollar. And again, subsequently, you saw an immediate reaction in the broad equities market. And at that point, it was like my theory that this was the pinch point was confirmed. And at that point, we need to discuss narrative, because even those companies, like over the past few months, you saw all sorts of rare earth element companies fly, but I wanted a company that I could buy call options in, knowing that this narrative could really make it fly, so to speak, but also would be in line with other catalysts that could materialize should this rare earth element thesis not develop the way that I believed it would. Which landed me at Energy Fuels, because they were in the middle of constructing a rare earth element separation process at their White Mesa mill, which also is the only operating and fully licensed uranium mill in the United States. And they also bought several rare earth element projects. So they were looking to become one of the only Western integrated rare earth element processors. And I thought that part of the story alone will be enough to really drive them upwards. Should that not have been the case, they were also ramping up uranium production. Their Pinyon Plain uranium mine has done very well. So that alone would be enough to kind of underpin or back the call options. And then you have like a call option on your call option with regards to the rare earth element thesis. both of which turned out to be true. And then we had simply an absolutely incredible run on both the equity position and the call option position. So the way that I looked at it, it was backed, it was underpinned, like the foundation for that trade was underpinned in my belief in their uranium side of the business. And everything on top of that foundation was based on my macro analysis on rare earth elements being that pinch point and energy fuels being looked at as kind of the US option together with MP Materials to build out a domestically secure US supply chain. Now, I will say that I did not expect the US government to really go out all guns blazing and start taking 10% equity positions in a bunch of these different material companies. But the fact that they went out and did that, that also kind of dictated more of a premium for energy fuels. But yeah, I would say that this thesis has worked out very, very well. And I am now looking to see where the next pinch point is to see if we can find another good trade.
Mm-hmm. Mark, obviously there's been, you know, more money and more attention come into this market. So let's say with the addition of hedge funds, bigger institutional players like, let's say, Sprott, and more investment, have you seen the market really change when more investment and more money has come into the sector?
I've seen parts of it change. Like for several, of course, like not for the small uranium equities, which are still mostly dominated by retail investor flows. These bigger uranium equities, we've seen them being able to secure a larger amount of capitals from more respected capital groups, so to speak, which I think is a significant tell. And also what you've seen is that you've seen companies like, or sort of big banks or big finance like JP Morgan or Morgan Stanley come into the space and start to underwrite some of these financing, start to open coverage on some of these uranium companies. You've seen some absolutely huge commodity trader funds come in and say, okay, we're also now going to dabble a little bit in uranium. We recently saw that as well. And I think that was really a sign of the times. And I think it makes the market more efficient because then you have quote unquote stronger hands that believe more in the thesis because these guys do a lot of work. But it also, of course, adds to the volatility because if we see a broad equities market correction and they start to sell, it will have an outsized impact to the downside. But yeah, I think we have seen more of that flows. I think that will continue to have an impact. And I think we'll see more of that because even though we have already seen more of that institutional capital participation, this market still only has a cumulative publicly traded market cap of, I believe, around $85 to $90 billion right now. That was on my last calculation. I probably need to up that right now after the recent run, possibly towards $100 billion. But in the grand scheme of things, that is still relatively tiny. $100 billion is something that NVIDIA or Microsoft or Apple would shed or add in a single day of trading. I think that's significant, and I think that that is something that will have an impact going forward. I think we will see more institutional capital participation. I think we will see more coverage from the larger banks. But right now, I think that we are not there just yet. Speaking to some of these institutional capital groups, they know that they like the thesis, they like where this is going, they are a big believer in nuclear power, they are a big believer in the supply-demand deficit that we discussed, but they simply cannot play in this market, as they like to call it, beyond some of the larger, more liquid equities like your Cameco's, your UACs, your NexGen's, your especially these Sprott Physical Uranium Trust as well, which has had a massive impact, perhaps some of these ETFs. But beyond that, the equities are simply too small to really have an impact. And I think that the fact that these companies have been more liquid, so to speak, and have allowed for more of these flows to come in has caused them to have an outsized returns compared to some of these smaller equities, because you've seen Cameco doing extremely well, partly because of their Westinghouse components, of course, because that has done amazingly well in the grand scheme of this nuclear renaissance. But I think that liquidity is an important part for capital flows. I think we will see more of these industrial capital flows at the risk of sounding like a broken record, but we're not there yet in terms of really broad scale participation.
Do you think that a lot of these greenfields projected, let's say, pounds that would come out are optimistic assumptions?
I would say so. Yes, I've become pretty critical of a lot of these brownfield, but especially also greenfield projects that are promising very consistent, very reliable production at prices that I would normally look at and say, okay, that would be very impressive if you would reach that. But I think that this is something that I need to be careful with, because we have seen time and again that the brownfield restarts in particular, which was supposed to be the proverbial low-hanging fruit that could come online at higher uranium prices, that they've started running into issues either on budgeting or on timing or just also on geology. Like we've seen with Boss Energy's Honeymoon, they've run into geological issues that are not as easily solved by just throwing more money at the problem. And I think that that is something that we need to take into account. And I think that some of these juniors, or let me rephrase that, I think a lot of these juniors are over-promising, and they will need to do a lot to actually deliver on those promises, not just for themselves or the shareholders, but also for the end users. A lot of these utilities are looking at the supply-demand deficits, and they see the supply-demand deficit, but they're also looking at a million fancy presentations that are telling them, hey, we can produce 1.5 million pounds, 2.5 million pounds, 4 million pounds, 500,000 pounds, you name it. We can produce that at $35 all in sustaining costs, and we can start producing in 2028. Those promises, of course, then you become more, maybe I don't want to call it complacent, but then of course you become a lot more confident in the fact that, okay, they can deliver these pounds, but these pounds will come showing up at my doorstep. But I don't think it will be that easy. And that circles back all the way to something we discussed at the start of the interview, the fact that paper coverage on your balance sheet is not the same as fundamental coverage. So I think they would do well at being a little bit more prudent with what they might promise to the market and just letting their actions show what they can actually deliver instead of letting their presentation show. Because again, I think that a lot of these end users and a lot of these investors might just be disappointed. Even as the uranium price rises, they might not deliver what they want, that they originally wanted to do on paper, because simply uranium mining is hard. It is a difficult endeavor, and it's just not something that a lot of people actually know how to do. And I think that more people would do well to remember that.
Martin, how does the AI piece fit into here? You know, Microsoft is throwing, you know, tons of money at the Palisades project or
also the Three Mile Islands reactor that they want to restart.
Yeah. So how does the AI demand picture come in here as well? And what, how big of a new source of demand is that going to be?
I think it will be massive. If you look at some of these power demand projections in the US going forward, if you would have a normal linear pathway going forward that accounts for normal growth, it would already need a lot more power to come online to meet that growth. But if you then plug in the potential, I say potential because it really feels like we're in kind of an AI bubble right now. I don't think that it will stop. I think we will use more AI. I think we will see more data centers. But I think some of these projections are a little bit over the top and bubbly, if you want to call it that. But still, I think we will see a lot more demand. Do I think it will be absolutely paramount to the thesis playing out that we need to see all this AI demand? No, I do not. These nuclear power plants, they are already in place and they will already be delivering power. These have already been completely de-risked. And the fact that this part of this AI demand is bringing back old power plants, it's all gravy, Tom. It is all just cherries on an already very good-looking pie. So right now, I am accounting for some of that AI demand to translate into more power demand that will subsequently also translate into more demand for nuclear power and uranium. But I'm also worried. And that's why, and one of the sides that people don't often discuss is that, okay, it's all gravy and it's all additional demand that will come online and it's very, very good. Yes, in part, but something that also needs to be taken into account, that this AI demand bubble has, if it's a bubble, of course, because if it just goes on and on and on from here, it will just get more and more crazy. But if it pops in any way, shape or form, it will also drag down some of these uranium equities, because whether we like it or not, these uranium equities have tied themselves a little bit to this AI hype, because these uranium equities will be what powers the AI revolution, is a headline that I've seen multiple times on Bloomberg. So that's something that we need to take into account. And yes, I think we will see more AI demands. Yes, I think that will drive more uranium demand in the future as well. I think in the short term, it will drive more gas demand, because some of these data centers will want to be plugged into a baseload power source, and we cannot build a nuclear power plant tomorrow. It's way easier to plug them into existing gas plants or to build new gas plants. Down the line, I think they will need more nuclear power because they want to fill those ESG demands being powered by clean, reliable, carbon-free baseload power. But that's the long term. And I think that will have an impact. I also think that one thing that should be taken into account is that a lot of these AI giants could have a different sort of impact. And what I mean by that is that they are already looking for nuclear power. And from what I've been hearing, especially at WNA as well, is that they are slowly but surely trying to dabble a little bit in fuel cycle. They are looking to perhaps say, okay, you, as a utility, you may be being a little bit more too conservative with regards to buying your uranium. We don't want to have that risk. We want to make sure that we can fuel the power for these data centers. We are going to go out there and secure contracts. We're going to go out there and secure fuel. We are hearing more and more noises about that. And I even heard one contact of mine that has spent a lot of time on this over the past few years. He's a real veteran of the sector. He noted that some of these companies could go ahead and sign 15 to 20 year agreements for fuel, which is absolutely massive. So they are, for them, money is not really a problem. They will throw at it what is needed in order to receive their power. So I think that if they start to dabble more and more in the fuel cycle, these price insensitive buyers, them and the government, of course, with the US government saying that they want to bolster their US strategic supply of uranium, these price insensitive buyers will have an outsized impact on this market. To what extent, we still need to find out, because more details are yet to be released. But I think it's something, it's a right tail risk that really just adds to a thesis that was already strong enough without it.
Yeah. Mark, obviously we've focused a lot on uranium here, but how do you think about de-risking your portfolio? You know, you don't just invest in uranium-focused equities. What else is very important to you in order to build a somewhat de-risked portfolio?
I think it's important to, first of all, invest what you have conviction in, because otherwise you get shaken out by volatility. But I think it's a very, very good question that you ask, because even though I am very confident in the price of uranium going up over the coming years, it is my highest conviction. Yes, because I have done the most work into it, but I have done the most work out of anything that I've invested in because the fundamentals are so strong. But that doesn't mean I'm advocating for 100% exposure to uranium, because something can always go wrong. You could have a nuclear accident. You could have a technological breakthrough that could either substantially increase supply or substantially decrease demand. I don't think that will happen, but it's something that you need to take into account. And it's a risk that simply dictates that I cannot be fully 100% with my portfolio being invested in this, no matter how big my conviction is. So that means that you need to find other opportunities as well. So right now, the majority of my portfolio is in uranium. I also run a Codex portfolio, and in it, the largest holdings are uranium, but substantial holdings also include gold and silver, because I believe that we are at the cusp of something of a monetary reset. No, I don't think we're all going to be burning our dollars and euros in the streets, and we're all going to be living purely off commodities again. But I do think that gold will have a reclaimed spot in the EU, or in the not only US but the global financial system, as a neutral reserve asset above US bonds or US treasuries. So that has a lot of conviction on my end. So that is a fifth of the portfolio. Then there is oil and gas. I think that is very important to hold at least some of that, especially with all the geopolitical turmoil we're seeing. We have some copper. We have some US industrial equities that have great fundamentals on their own, apart from just cyclical commodities. But in the end, most of my conviction is in commodities, because I like to invest in real stuff that is made to make real stuff. I can model it. I can model supply demand. I know what they're used for. I know new use cases, old use cases. And it's just very, very good to kind of get into that mindset of that we're entering a new decade where commodities will become more important, especially with these fragile supply chains. So I am positioning my portfolio accordingly. With regards to uranium, it is a large part of my portfolio. No, it's not 100%, because that will be too big of a risk. I have a core part of the portfolio that is just long, and then I try to trade around that by trimming when we see euphoric sentiment, and by adding when we see depression level sentiment, and also by buying and selling these call options, which have of course done exceptionally well. And I think that's the right way to approach this market, because you want to make use of the volatility we're seeing, like that can be very profitable. So you want to make use of that, but you also want to just stay long in case we see one of these extremely bullish right tail risks materialize, and then things just go ballistic from there, which is absolutely a possibility.
Mm-hmm. So Mark, when we understand that much of your thesis is based around uranium and power generation, are there other commodities that you're exposed to specifically that support that thesis as well, like copper and maybe tin?
Copper, absolutely. I think tin is also very interesting, because especially for chip making, which we will need a lot more of if we were to really power this new AI generation, I think tin is very significant. The fact that tin is, just like uranium, so concentrated with regards to supplying just a few countries, most of those countries not being especially politically stable, if you want to call it that, is something you need to take into account. I think tin is very interesting. I think copper is very interesting, because we are going to need such an insane amount of copper, and all these legacy mine assets, all these old giants like Escondida, they're going to need to be replaced as they kind of run off slowly but surely, and demand just keeps increasing. Of course, I think gold and silver is very interesting. I think that some of these other critical materials, like rare earth element processing, but also like tungsten, are interesting. Beyond that, I think that oil and gas have been extremely unloved this year. Like in a year, literally everything has flown to the upside. All these risk assets, oil and gas equities, have not necessarily participated in the upside. I think that that could change next year. And if everybody hates a sector that is so important to global trade, global just the way that we live as a society, I think that will have an impact, especially as the oil price keeps dropping, because the oil sector is so dependent on US shale just producing enough to really make up the difference. We've seen US shale increase in production. I don't think it's a sustainable trend, especially not at these prices. I think US shale needs at least $75 to $80 to really stay at the production level that they're at, let alone add more. So I think that's something to take into account. So oil and gas is kind of the next sector that I'm watching for an opportunity. But right now, I am having far too much fun riding this uranium and precious metals train to the upside. But there will be an end to it at some point.
Mm-hmm. Well, Martin, I think that's a good place to kind of put a pin in it for today. I really appreciate you walking us through and explaining your process on a lot of this, on a lot of this stuff. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners with to think about or to consider before we wrap up?
I think it's important that at this point, with the market being so incredibly frothy and bullish, that, and we talked about this off air as well, that if you think and you feel like you are extremely smart and you want to show your profits to everyone, to your wife, to your husband, to your friends, to your family, whomever it might be, it may be time to take some profits and to thank the market for what it has given you and just kind of ride it out. You always want to have some liquidity. And I think we will have another opportunity to add. And the way that I've kind of described it before is that for those who have ever gone on a trip through the desert, you will know that it is absolutely beautiful. There is something, there is a raw, beautiful nature about it. But you also know that it is grueling, not only during the day, but also at night, where it just cools off incredibly, incredibly hard. But during the day, if you go for a long trek, you want to make sure that you have packed your bags with all the necessary material before you reach what we should call the next oasis. Right now, we are in an oasis. If you do not prepare for it for the next trek, you may find yourself having to cut up a cactus in order to just keep going until you reach the next oasis. So it might sound kind of dreamy, if you want to call it. I don't know what the right word for it is, but I think it will pay to prepare for worse times during better times. So I think that is something that is important. It's something that we're doing at the Contrarian Codex right now. And yeah, I think it's prudent right now to be a little cautious, at least.
That's a good analogy. I like how you put that. Of course, yeah. For anybody that wants to find more from Mart, he's available on X at YellowBull11, as well as patreon.com/contrariancodex. Mart, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, and I hope everybody listening has a good and healthy rest of their day.
Wonderful.